The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Good morning and welcome to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org and always available via podcast. You can find us on iTunes. We are on Amazon. We're on Stitcher and other podcast platforms under Writers on Writing. You can follow us on Facebook, Writers on Writing. We are on Twitter at WOWKUCIFM. You can follow our websites. Barbara's is penonfire.com. Mine is mariestone.com. Barbara's got speaker series events. We've got 23 years of interviews up there. You can search your favorite author and find them up there. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone. We are doing what we do every Wednesday morning, which is chat with authors about their books, their process, their craft, their publishing experiences, whatever else comes up. I have been hungry for a while for a super immersive novel, one of those door stoppers where you can lose yourself for 800 pages in a multi-generational family saga. And then Honoré Jeffers' book came along and I got to disappear into it for like five head-spinning days where I, you know, didn't get dressed. So the crazy thing about this debut 800-page novel is that it was written by a poet. Honoré Fanon Jeffers is a fiction writer, a poet, and an essayist. She is the author of five poetry collections, including the collection The Age of Phyllis, which was longlisted for the 2020 National Book Award. She was a contributor for The Fire This Time, A New Generation Speaks About Race, edited by Jessamine Ward, and has been published in the Kenyon Review, the Iowa Review, and other literary publications. She was elected to the American Antiquarian Society, whose members include 14 U.S. presidents, and is a critic at large for the Kenyon Review. She teaches creative writing and literature at the University of Oklahoma. The Love Songs of W.E.B. Du Bois is the book we are talking about this morning. It is published by Harper. Honoré, welcome.
Thank you so much.
So this book is amazing. It has the feel of a book you've been writing in some way or another your whole life. Does it kind of feel that way to you, or is that, or is that projection?
Yeah, it really does. Because before I started writing the novel, I was writing stories set in this same fictitious town. Wow. So I've been writing about Chickasetta, Georgia, the fictitious town, for probably about 20, 21 years, something like that. Yes. Wow.
You said that your grandmother was a gardener. I think there's an author's note at the beginning of the book where you talk about your grandmother being a gardener. And though you didn't take up her love of gardening, you've sort of been tending, as you say, you've sort of been tending this garden of people, populating it and kind of helping them grow for all these years. I love that metaphor of gardening your characters.
You know, that's the thing. My mother has a green thumb. All of her brothers and sisters, some are unfortunately no longer living, but they all gardened. They all kept flowers, but they also kept vegetables. They tended vegetables. And I never have been able to keep anything alive, but I tend to the stories or what is possible in these historical moments. Yes, I'm a child of Georgia.
So tell me a little bit about inventing this town. So you've been writing about this place, as you say, for 20 years. And talk a little bit about how that began before the novel began. That began, you know, 20 years ago. Tell me a little bit about what sparked your imagination and where some of these characters started bubbling up from.
Back when I was in graduate school at the University of Alabama, I am a graduate of the MFA program at the University of Alabama. I was in the poetry program, but we all had to take a different genre. So if you were a poet, you had to take what they call baby fiction. If you were a fiction writer, you had to take baby poetry. There were special classes just, you know, within your genre. So when I was taking baby fiction, I started writing about the mother of the protagonist of the novel, The mother is Belle and the protagonist is Ailey Pearl Garfield. And I hadn't even envisioned Ailey at that point. I was only thinking about Belle. But I remember, and the scene that I wrote for that class is actually in the novel. But I think I missed home. My mother is from Eatonton, Georgia. Her family is from Eatonton in Milledgeville, Georgia. And I spent my summers in Eatonton from the time that I was a little girl. And then we moved down to Atlanta when I was in high school. So I spent a lot of time in Eatonton and I missed it. And so I think I just started creating this fictitious town so I could be closer to the people. And that's how that began. That's how I started writing stories. And that's all I ever wanted to do. I never wanted to write a novel. But then I got with my literary agent, Sarah Burns. And, you know, Sarah is both incredibly nurturing and she just, you know, is a tough talker at the same time. I don't know how she does both of those at the same time, but she's just fantastic. So she told me up front, there's no money in stories. You know, unless you are Alice Munro or, you know, someone like that, you're not going to make money in stories. If you want to write stories, that's fine. But just know you're not going to make any money. So I just kept writing my stories because I was kind of stubborn. But, you know, the thing about it is I really loved Sarah. We connected from the very beginning, from our very first phone conversation. And I wanted to keep her. And so I knew I had to make her some money in order to keep her because we just had this great relationship. So I told her, I lied and told her I was working on a novel, but I really wasn't. I really just was trying to string along some stories together, you know, maybe do, you know, a Olive Kittredge thing, you know, with Elizabeth Strout, right? But it just didn't work. Every time I would send something, Sarah would say, well, this is beautiful, but I don't see how this is working toward a novel. So run along. Probably maybe 6 years into maybe 5 years into my professional relationship with Sarah, I began really working on a novel in earnest, and it was supposed to be just about Ailey. It was supposed to be a light story, right? People always laugh.
I love this. Yes. Keep going.
It was supposed to be a light story, just sort of a family story, a coming of age and, you know, a beach read. And that's what, you know, that's what I was planning. And then all of a sudden I started having dreams about these people and I could see them so vividly. And I knew when I would be having the dreams, that these were ancestors, you know, that I was, you know, when I would be seeing these people, I would see a plantation house in the distance. I would see all of that and they would speak to me. And then when I would wake up, I would write whatever they said, you know, down in my little Moleskine notebook. But I didn't understand what this was supposed to, you know, what this had to do with Ailey. I didn't get it. And then maybe about a year, 18 months into these strange dreams, I still have these dreams. It became very apparent to me that these were Ailey's ancestors. But the other issue was that the language of these interludes, whatever it was, because I didn't call them songs at the time, the language was so lyrical and you know, nearly poetic and totally different from Ailey's voice. It was very confusing to me. And I felt like if I wanted to be a real novelist, that I wouldn't use that kind of language, that my language would be very straightforward and natural. And so I wrestled with that for a while. And then I just surrendered that, you know, these were two different voices. And it was what it was.
They are totally different voices. I see what you mean. And as I was reading this, I was thinking, it's amazing this came out of a poet. And I went back and read your poetry, and they are. I mean, your command over these two completely different narrative structures is really remarkable. And this idea of the dreams coming to you, which you incorporate throughout the book, this happens to your characters as well. Dreams come to them, which I thought of as sort of this kind of magical realism element to the novel, which I thought was really lovely. But I wonder if you think of it that way, or if you think of it as really very literal.
You know, so this is not an autobiographical novel at all.
Yeah, right.
But there are aspects that sort of are parallel. And in my family, in my maternal line, we are dreamers. I remember something happening. I won't say what it is, but let's just say something naughty. And my mother came up to me the next morning and she said, "Is there something you want to say to me?" Wow. And she just like looked at me very sternly. And I said, no, ma'am. And then my sister came to me and she said, "Mama knows." So I come from the women in my family have these sort of different, you know, the Native American people call it medicine, right? That's what I learned when I moved out here to Oklahoma, because this is Native American Central. Mm-hmm. And so my great grandmother knew folk medicine. And her daughter, my granny, it's almost like plants would grow out of the tips of her fingers. It was really amazing. And then my mother is the same with things growing, but she's a dreamer. And I didn't think I had inherited any of that. And then when I hit probably my mid 40s, I'm in my 50s now, I became a dreamer. And so I would dream things and then they would happen. And it was very disconcerting. And then I just sort of surrendered, right? So I do think of it as both magical realism. There are some things in the book that are, you know, completely not realistic, right? Mm. No spoilers, right?
You
read the book, so you know what I'm talking about. Yeah. There are some things that are completely not realistic. And then there are some things that I do look as literal, because there are a lot of African-American women that I know in the Deep South who are dreamers, or whose grandmother or great-grandmother knew roots, as we say, right? Knew how to work roots or different things like that. You also would get women who were very prophetic religiously, right? So they would testify in church. So there are these different kind of things. And then there are aspects of folklore that I interpret in the book, aspects of Native American folklore, aspects of African American folklore. And one of the things that I found very interesting when I moved out here, which is very similar to African American culture, is that many Native American people that I've encountered out here do not view certain things as folklore, but they do view it as literal. So you have to be very respectful not to dismiss what they view as real life occurrences. Right. And it's the same thing in African American culture. You can't dismiss it as superstitious. It is real to them.
Right.
And that was one of the things that I wanted to explore in the book. What do we view as real? What do we view as superstitious, and so on and so forth?
Well, let me tell you, if a dream came to me and helped me write a book, I would accept and embrace it. It would be an amazing thing. And it sounds like there was another allusion to your author note at the beginning. It sounds like there was a nice oral tradition of maybe storytelling in your family. It sounded like you were kind of an eavesdropper who liked to listen in on the women's stories. And I don't know how much of that fueled your imagination for the novel, those early stories, childhood stories that you heard from the women in your family.
Definitely. Well, my family, not only there as a late friend of mine, James, he's part of the dedication in the book is to James. James called my mother a brilliant raconteur, right? And so, so yes, my folks, my mother's people, female and male, are very much storytellers, but they also have very hardcore senses of humor. Hmm. And so when you see Ailey in the book and how she just takes no prisoners with her sense of humor, I grew up with people like that. But what I did was I made her voice a contemporary voice as opposed to sort of the old folks. So yes, there very much was a tradition of I wasn't a child that really played a lot. I was a sedentary child. I read a lot. And I spent a lot of time around old people. And I wanted to communicate that as well in the book by the fact that all of the contemporary people call elders Mr., Ms., aunt, uncle. You never see an older person called by their first name.
Right.
That is very Black Southern and Southern. We do not believe in young folks calling us by our first names. That's a very cultural thing. And so I wanted to communicate that as well. But yes, the storytelling is very important. Uncle Root and his Du Bois story that changes. And the other story about his interaction with the Franklins. All of this is part of, you know, the way that I learned Black history before I learned it in books was through listening to old folks talk about Jim Crow. And then when I encountered formal academic history in books, I realized the historians that I gravitated to were those that they put flesh on the bones of the historical figures. Yeah. It wasn't just this happened, this happened, this happened, but they told stories about the history. And those were the people that I was most, like, for example, right now, I mentioned her in the acknowledgments or the archival coda in the back of my book. Dr. Taya Miles has a book out now about an enslaved woman whose child was sold away from her. And so when they were about to take her child away, she cut off her plait and sewed it into a sack. And then that sack followed, was passed down through the family. Mm-hmm. She tell, you know, it's almost like a novel, mm-hmm. the way that she tells history. And so those are the historians that I gravitate toward because of the storytelling legacy of my family.
Well, we've talked a bunch on the show about how much fiction can accomplish in changing minds and imbuing the reader with a lot of empathy that nonfiction really can't do. You know, you come to nonfiction, you're going to have a selective audience who picks up a nonfiction book to be, I, you know, we always say fiction is not meant to persuade, but that's the effect that it has because the details are so visceral and the emotions are so raw that you know, the reader can't help but sympathize with what the characters are going through in a way you really can't in nonfiction. And so, yeah, no surprise that you would gravitate towards that. And then the information sticks in your brain. It becomes so, you know, so much more sticky after you have all of this emotion to attach to it and empathy to attach to it. So yeah, I get it. Well, we should step back and kind of formally introduce the book. We haven't totally done that. So for people who haven't yet picked it up, you know, I certainly alluded to it being a multi-generational book, but maybe you can kind of set the stage. You'll do a way better job than I will on all of the generations. I have an advanced reader's copy, so mine did not come with the family tree, but I set out to try and make one, and then I got really overwhelmed and then I couldn't do it.
So. It's a big family tree. I mean, some of the people that have received ARCs, you know, that I know, I've emailed them the family tree.
Oh, do that for me. I'd love that.
I will do that, because there are like several different branches of the same family and all of that. And it, and the family tree wasn't ready when the ARC was printed.
Sure.
So the Love Songs of W.B. Du Bois, as you've already mentioned, is an intergenerational epic, and it travels from the past to the present to tell the story of one family that has European, Indigenous, and African ancestry. And this one family has lived on this same piece of land in rural Georgia since before there was even a place called Georgia, when the land belonged to the Creek people. And so the story is told in two parts. One part is the songs, and those are the historical stories that go all the way back to the 18th century. The other part is from the point of view of Ailie Pearl Garfield, who's the protagonist of the novel. And it's a coming of age of, you know, her learning how to navigate the world, learning how to navigate this horrible event that happened in her childhood. And then along the way, these two stories intersect. And you begin to learn things. I don't want to give any spoilers.
Right.
But the reason that the book is called, and some people even thought that this was a historical novel about W.B. Du Bois, right?
And I'm guilty of that, yes.
Right. And I had explained to people, the reason that the book is called that is because W.B. Du Bois is the greatest African-American intellectual of the 20th century. And I would argue, if he's not the greatest American intellectual, he's certainly up in the top three. Yeah. And he was fascinated by and devoted to Black Southern people. He went to college in Nashville, Tennessee. He originally was from Massachusetts. And he went to college as a teenager in Nashville, Tennessee at Fisk University. This is where he first encountered what used to be called the Negro spirituals, the songs that were composed by enslaved African Americans. And it had a profound effect on him. And then later, after he was the first Black person to earn a doctorate at Harvard University, he traveled to Georgia and taught at an historically Black college, Atlanta University. He left Atlanta and then he returned to Atlanta. And some of his work continues to return back to Georgia. And so the love songs are his devotion to these people and the people that to whom he devoted his life's work. And so the songs are little snippets from his work that sort of drive the narrative of the book. So in each section of the book, you'll get a quote from some work by W.B. Du Bois, and it will directly connect with whatever's happening in that particular section. But I should say that that this book never was intended to include Du Bois. But Uncle Root, who is a very important character in the book, was really just supposed to come in and leave. And I love Uncle Root. Yes. I love him so much. And he loves Black women. He's very feminist. And Uncle Root, when he first appeared in this book, he told this story about meeting W.B. Du Bois. And when Uncle Root became a bigger figure in the book and he kept telling these stories, that's when it occurred to me that this would be a useful framework for the book. And that's how it became the love songs of W.B. Du Bois.
And it's a really great way to introduce some history and some information without being didactic, right?
Yes. And thank you so much for saying that, because I've written about African-American history and to a lesser extent, Southeastern Indigenous history throughout my career. And one of the things that you can't do when you base literature upon history, you can't shoehorn the history into whatever you're writing.
Yeah.
It has to evolve organically. And that's what I realized, that so few people really know about slavery history. And as few people as we have that know about slavery history, even fewer know about Indigenous history. And I knew that when I began writing about Chickasetta, and in my imagination, I knew the history and everything else. And over the years, you know, I had the genealogies and all of that. But it was when I decided that I would set part of the novel in the time before slavery was legal in Georgia, the 18th century, that I realized I had to tell the story of the Creek people who lived on this piece of land, because the land originally had belonged to them.
Yeah.
And so it was not going to be respectful. But I was really scared. You know, I had to really ask myself, did I have a right to tell that story? And the way that, you know, I prayed on it, I meditated on it, the way that I finally said, okay, was, you'll notice that except for one small character, all the Indigenous characters are mixed race.
Right.
They're African Indigenous or they're Scottish Indigenous. And that was how I gave myself permission to do that, because I wanted to be respectful, because there are Indigenous writers who were doing that work. And I didn't want to take over that narrative.
Well, you can count me amongst the ignorant of this part of U.S. history. I just had kind of missed the cross-section of the Native American experience, of the Indigenous experience with the African-American experience. And it was so illuminating. And I learned so much. And I thought, yeah, if you didn't give yourself permission to do that, how does that story get told? You know, I just think that that intersection and all that history, it has to be told. So I'm glad you took the risk. I understand the hesitation, but I'm so glad that you gave yourself permission to do that, because I think it's an important texture that I was wholly unaware of. So
most people aren't aware of it. There aren't even a lot of historians who do that work. Mm-hmm. And so there are a handful. The historian that I mentioned earlier, Taya Miles, she does that work. And there are a few others. It's a field that's growing, but it's still very small. And then when you're talking about Black writers who write about that, it's very small. And just that, those few pages, what, 30, 40, 50 pages, something like that, took me about 7 years of research. right. Just those. It took me a lot. But one of the things that I found really, really interesting is that when I was looking at the Georgia archives online to look at the land lottery, you know, how they stole the land from the Native Americans, I came upon what were called slave codes. And these were early rules for movement and behavior and all of that for African Americans in the 18th century. Mm. And one of the things that I found really interesting was that Native Americans were included in these slave codes. Mm. And I thought, wow. So what this meant was that Native Americans were both free and unfree at the same time that African Americans were enslaved. And I found that really fascinating. There are a lot of intersections that I noticed when I was writing the book. The Federal Road that was forced through the Cherokee and the Creek lands in Georgia is the same road when people talked about, you hear that term, sold down the river.
Mm-hmm.
That originates with selling enslaved African Americans down the Mississippi. And that same Federal Road that was forced through indigenous lands is the road where enslaved African Americans were sold to New Orleans and so forth. So there are a lot of intersections between African American history and Native American history. And I didn't realize that until I started doing all that research.
My guest this morning is Honoré Jeffers. The book we are talking about is The Love Songs of W.E.B. Du Bois. You are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Well, we talk a lot about the importance of place in fiction and how place can become a character. But in this book, it really struck me how deeply true that is to the point that you just made, which is this place holds so much history, so much blood in its soil that, you know, as you talk about it, bring it to life over time and what it came to mean in present day time in Eileen's life. It's this large looming character in the book. And I imagine that you have gone to whatever, I know the place is sort of imaginary, but you have been to these places.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. And the land actually is a character. It's like you bring that up. The land actually speaks at the beginning of the book when it says, we are the land. Yes, Rock Eagle is a real place in Georgia. So there are all these sort of, the Trail of Tears came right through Milledgeville. Mm-hmm. So there are all these sort of places. It's when I was a little girl and I would go to these places. Like I was supposed to go back to Eatonton in 2019 and I was going to go to Rock Eagle. And then I thought about, I just can't be stomping all over these sacred grounds, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's been made into this sort of landmark and people go, but people would take rocks from the Rock Eagle. So they had to put a fence around it. And I just thought, I just didn't feel good about it, you know? And I always thought about, what does the land remember that people cannot?
Right.
If the land is timeless, what will the land remember after the people who were there are gone, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Don't tell me they put a Walmart on it. That would be...
Oh, wow. You know, that's what you think about. You think
it is.
I remember when this was maybe about 15 years ago, I was with my mama and we were driving, you know, driving through that area. I think we were there for the family reunion, although I can't be sure. And so I asked my mama to take me to where she used to live when she was a little girl. And my mother's family was very poverty stricken. Very poor. My mother's father could not read and write. I don't like to use the word illiterate. It seems so mean sounding. Mm. But he could not read and write. And my grandma, Grandma Florence, she only went to probably the seventh or eighth grade, because at that time, the schools for African-American children didn't go beyond probably eighth grade. And then what would happen is the white planters during harvest time and during planting time, they would send their foremen to the African-American schools to pull children out.
Mm.
And so the education was very truncated. And so my mother was not only the first person in her family to go to college, she was the first person in her family to go past eighth grade.
Wow.
And she was literally born in a former slave shack. And so I asked Mama, she said, well, you know, the house has been torn down and stuff, but I'll take you. And so she started trying to take me to pass Beaver Dam. That's what she called it. But everything had been changed and she couldn't find any of the landmarks. And she was very upset. And I was kind of kicking myself, you know, that I had brought this pain on her, you know. But yes, the land constantly changes. I learned how to drive in Atlanta when I was 18. And so I can drive, you know, the interstate, but so much has changed, you know. I don't recognize a lot of it. And I think that's the thing, you know, what the places that were beloved by you as a child, sometimes they just don't remain the same. And in a real way, I am not an environmentalist, but I would say that this is an environmental book, Quiet as It's Kept. I think a lot of people would see it more about Indigenous history and slavery history, but it's also about what happens to the land over the years, the decades, the centuries.
Well, let's break it apart because I kind of want to understand how you did this. The whole time I was reading, I was like, how did she do this? So as you say, the story is told in kind of two parallel sections. The songs take place in late 19th century.
Late
18th century, right?
No, it's okay. It starts in 1733.
Right.
And that's when the first boat of Europeans that are settling, you know, settler colonists come to the land. And then it ends around the Civil War.
Yes. So tell me a little bit about the writing. Did you write that section to understand the history of what had happened to Ailey kind of in one swoop, or did you write it as the book presents itself, which is back and forth in time?
Well, I know. No, you know, I wish I could be, I'm trying to be one of these fiction writers that outlines things.
No, don't. I think that's the death of fiction.
But I have a friend who's a novelist, Krista Wilkinson, and she always says structure is the last frontier.
Yes.
So certainly things changed in the songs as I moved through revisions, etc. But I've told people and they kind of gasped. I didn't think it was shocking. But the last scene, the next to last scene in the book, I wrote before I wrote anything else.
And I
wrote toward that. So I knew, trying not to give spoilers,
right?
I knew that certain things were going to happen because of Ailey's trajectory. So I knew Ailey's story. And I knew that she was going to encounter certain things in history. And so what I had to do is I had to frame her story so that it would, again, be organic, that she would encounter these particular moments in her history instead of everything being shoehorned in. So I knew that there were, so like the first chapter of the book, I don't really feel like there are ever spoilers if you're talking about the first chapter of the book, right?
Fair,
so
yes.
The first chapter of the book, when the Coromanti, the young man who calls himself Coromanti, and we never find out what his true name is, when he comes into the Creek Village, the place in the middle of the tall trees, I knew that he was an ancestor of Ailey.
Yes.
Okay. I knew that he was going to marry Woman of the Wind.
Yes.
And I knew that the matrilineal, you know, line of Ailey, I knew that that was going to descend from those two people, that yes. they were going to be, you know, the most important. I also knew that Ailey was never going to know their names. Mm-hmm. And so these sort of things sort of cropped up. But what would happen is there are just a lot of random pages in Moleskine notebooks where I wrote it down and I said, okay, I would put that at the top of the bookcase and say, okay, something's in there and I'm going to come back to that. Or I would type it up and save it on the cloud. And then I'd write. And then at some point I'd say, I think there was something I wrote 2 years ago that will fit into this. So that's how I just sort of inched along. But I knew that I wanted to tell not just a historical story, but I wanted to tell, let me back up. I think one of the things that I found very interesting is when I first started writing Ailey's story, I was very frightened of telling that story. Because Ailey is take no prisoners about racial issues, about gender issues, and we were in a different political moment. We're in a moment where people were saying we're post-racial. I started writing this book late 2011, early 2012. President Obama was still president. And we had a much different racial landscape. And so I was really afraid that people were going to think that I was being rude or, you know, being prejudiced, like a lot of stuff. I was really scared. And not only that, we were in a moment where people were questioning why we should even be talking about slavery anymore. Mm-hmm. I found it very interesting that, and I'm not talking about white people, I'm talking about Black people. Mm-hmm. I find it very interesting that some of the same young folks a year ago, who were like, or 2 years ago, who were like, I'm tired of hearing about slavery. Why can't we ever talk about when Black people win? Why do we have to talk about all this tragedy, et cetera? And then George Floyd happened. And then now the Tulsa Race Massacre commemoration, you know, young Black folks are like, why didn't they teach us this in school? And I have to come back around and say, remember when you said you didn't want to hear about slavery, right? Mm-hmm. So it's a different moment. But I knew I wanted Black people to recognize Ailey's story, okay? Mm-hmm. Her story is the story of so many Black people. Very few people read about middle-class Black people. Very few people read about middle-class Black women. Very few people have heard about historically Black colleges. Many people didn't even know they existed until Vice President Kamala Harris. First, she was running for president, and then he was Senator Joe Biden picked her as his running mate. And then all of a sudden, people heard about Howard University. They heard about African-American sororities and fraternities. So I really wanted Black people who had shared an experience with Ailey to recognize themselves, but I also wanted non-Black people to be like a fly on the wall of Black culture, that they were going to be seeing a portion of Black culture that is kept hidden, that Black people don't talk about, that they were going to hear conversations that Black people don't repeat. I wanted that. I wanted straight no chaser. And so Ailey was the hardest part, though, because first of all, she was in first person. I will never write another first person novel again. Okay. Ailey was the hardest part. Many people are very shocked when I tell them that the songs were like breathing. Songs, as difficult and painful as some of the events are in the songs, they were such a joy to write. They were just, I just felt so natural when I was, and probably because, you know, the poet in me was able to, you know, take off, which I was scared about. And I remember there was a very early draft that Sarah Burns, my agent, she saw and she said, "What happened? You ripped all the poetry out of the book. What happened?" And I was like, "Well, do you think people are going to take me seriously if, you know, it's so lyrical?" She was very upset. And I went back and I put it all in and I felt so good. And she said, "Oh, this is so much better," you know. But the biggest thing is the intersection of the songs with Ailey's story and with Belle's story and with Lydia's story.
Yeah,
I wanted the overriding message, right? But you don't want your message to hammer people over the head. But if there was a message, I wanted people to understand that, you know, what William Faulkner says is true. The past isn't dead. It isn't even the past. I wanted people to see. I had no idea that when I finished this book, that history was going to resonate so much.
Yeah.
I had no idea.
Well, I'm so glad you brought up the point of writing this book throughout all of these different, very differently charged points in our recent history, because I just think it's so interesting how the outside pressures of the world act upon the interior life of the novelist. And how could it help but have impacted your thinking about Ailey, who she was, what she was going through, in these very different in some extreme polar opposite cases of what we were enduring. I was just curious about that. I don't know at what stage the book was in revision. I assume it was completely done by 2020 and you were in revision mode at that point. But what you were thinking about as the pendulum just felt like it swung so far the other way in our national consciousness to hear it really ringing throughout this book. It must have been just a very surreal, incredible experience. Maybe you just looked at it and said, of course it would be like.
No, it was surreal. And I have to tell you that the book was nearly finished in 2017, when the men with tiki torches descended on Charlottesville. That was the moment that I started to feel weird, because in a moment, I went from thinking, well, this book is about the past, to thinking past is prologue.
Yeah.
So when 2017 happened, Charlottesville, that was really disturbing. And then I finished the first draft of the book that was submitted to editors, and several editors had bid on it, which is a very strange experience for a poet.
Yeah.
Because there's no money in poetry. So that was really weird. And then so 2018 came, and by that time it seemed like every week or so was a clown show.
Yeah.
Right? It was like a racial clown show. Then we also had Black men being killed by the police, mostly Black men, but Black women too, and Black children. So then things just started snowball. And so the book was accepted for publication by Erin Wicks at Harper, the great Erin Wicks. She's a genius and the world needs to know. My editor at Harper. And then I already felt like the book was sort of straight, no chaser. And Aaron just kept pushing me to go there. When we went into edits, she was like, don't be afraid. And I was like, but Aaron, Aaron. And she said, don't be afraid. Just, you know, go there. And yeah, so I went there. And then, you know, so I turned in the book late 2020. And then January 6th happened. And I thought, well, who knew that these moments would ever come back around again? You know, and there is no way that I would have had these moments come back around simply so my novel would be relevant. You understand what I'm saying? Yeah. Like, you know, I was willing to take that hit and have people say, well, this is in the past and you're writing about the past. And I was willing to say, well, the past is a relevant place. You know, I think we need to know about history, but there is no way that I would have ever wanted what we have gone through over these past 4 years to happen simply so that my novel would be, you know, relevant to contemporary times. It really has broken my heart. You know, it really has.
Well, and to your earlier point that you were writing in part for the Black experience of the novel, as opposed to, you know, that a lot of these issues were not talked about in the Black community.
Right.
You know, colorism really wasn't something that I have focused on myself. And so that was yet another texture that was really educational to me. And I think that conversation is illuminating and important. And so for you to have entered the book through the lens of, I want this to be a conversation amongst Black people, as opposed to, well, I mean, it should be a conversation amongst everyone. But that lens too, I thought was very interesting and maybe informed by the time that you were, you know, during the Obama years when you were writing this, that was a very relevant conversation to be having. And so that ribbon of the book is its own ribbon. And then it became just so much bigger because of the events.
Well, colorism is something that has been talked about in Black communities for a very long time. But I think that when President Obama was inaugurated and the way that Mrs. Obama, and I always joke with people, you know, I thought President Obama was okay, but I really liked him because of Michelle.
Right.
I mean, we love Michelle. You know? Right. Michelle is just like a rock star, you know. Totally. And I remember the sort of ugly ways that people outside of Black communities would talk about her. And I think one of the things that we loved about Obama was that he had married a dark brown skin woman. And that sort of color dynamic, light skin husband, dark skin wife, is very rare in Black communities. Right. So that was a conversation that we were having. But, oh, definitely. I mean, you know, the paper bag test, the fine tooth comb test. The fact that when you look at a lot of the early pictures of sororities in particular, and you see that everyone is very light skinned. These are issues that we talk about all the time in Black communities, but we do not share them outside of our community.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
So I wanted to tell a lot of tales out of school. Gender dynamics, you know, sexism within Black communities, you know, all of that. I wanted to just burst it wide open.
Right. Right.
I really felt that was important.
And good job. Yes. No, absolutely. Absolutely. And your way of writing, your way of writing about sex, I think was fantastic because It was sex in all of its various many, many complexities. And that's hard to do. You know,
I was embarrassed sometimes.
Good.
You know, with the but that's the other thing that I wanted to, I know that it's very painful and very difficult for people to read. I try to be graceful when dealing with childhood abuse. But I felt like that was important because we're in a Me Too moment. And I thought it was really important. And one of the reasons I also thought it was important is because not a lot in this book is universal. And so I wanted to have a moment where every woman could relate, right?
Yep.
A woman of any race.
Yep.
Because I knew that so much in this book was racially and culturally specific, but I wanted to have a moment where every woman could sort of say, aha, yep. Right? When we're dealing with Me Too throughout the centuries and also dealing with patriarchy and also these sort of particular moments where feminism is, you know, a difficult journey, even when you want it. Being, you know, walking the walk. Ailey, you know, has been a feminist since she's a child, right? Very, very empowered. But then when she becomes a woman, a young woman, then she is challenged to live up to those feminist principles. And I think that that's also something that women across racial and cultural lines can relate to.
And you can see how different women deal with similar situations in very different ways, right? Yeah. Right. How they internalize things and how they respond to things. Yeah.
Because everybody in a family isn't the same person.
Right.
And that's the other thing that I wanted to show, that even when women within the same family or children within the same family are confronted with the same issues, every person doesn't respond identically. And some people make it and some people don't make it.
How many points of view characters were in here? Because I know Ailey is the first person point of view.
Ailey's first person, right? Ailey is named after Alvin
Ailey. Sure, right. Of course, right.
Ailey's named after Alvin Ailey and her great-grandmother Pearl. And she's the only first person character, which makes her an unreliable narrator, right? We have Belle and we have Lydia, and they are close third. Close third is a point of view that I really love because it's almost first, right?
Yeah.
You get this really close, you know, this close point of view, you feel everything that someone's feeling, but they are a reliable narrator.
Yeah.
As opposed to a first person. And then we have the songs that are sometimes omniscient. And then, so when the land comes in, almost like a Greek chorus. Right?
Yes, right.
The land comes in, it's omniscient. But then when we focus on particular characters, Miko, Beauty, and, you know, Beauty renamed Aggie, right?
Yeah, right.
When we come upon those characters, then we move into not as close as Belle and Lydia, but not omniscient. Either.
Right.
And I, you know, that's the thing. And that's probably why my genius editor, Erin Wicks, she encouraged me to make this a longer book.
I don't know how you would cut any page of it. I really don't.
But the book that I sold was 450 pages.
Really?
I wrote 350 new pages.
Wow.
over like a 15 to 18 month period. Yeah.
So you just broadened what was there out, or what? Wait, what?
Well, there were moments where I mentioned a few minutes ago where she was like, go there. So
okay,
we got to line edits. But before we got to line edits, what happened? This is the joke that I tell, that she tricked me. So I sold the book, and she gave me, you know, the first letter, the editorial letter, where she was like, you know, this is what I see happening, character, da 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 da. And then she said, okay, well, I have another, you know, author, because that's what you learn, is that, you know, just as parents have, you know, different children, editors have more than you. So they have other authors that they have to tend to. So she said, okay, well, you know, I'm working, putting to bed, you know, a couple, three books. So you just write as much as you want. And I said, well, you know, the book is already long. And she said, oh, don't worry about that. We'll cut when we're in line edits. You just write as much as you want and just get it all out. So I said, are you sure? And she said, yeah, I'm really sure. So you know, I'm just writing away, because I'm like, well, we're going to cut all of this.
Oh my God, great.
She's just going to take that scalpel out, and we're going to stitch it all together. I'm mixing my metaphors here. We're going to stitch it all together, and it's going to be great. So I turn the book into her, and I don't hear back, and I'm terrified. So I'm like, oh, she's mad. She's mad. So finally, maybe about 6 weeks later, you know, I text her and I say, Erin, I'm a little scared, you know, and let me say that I've already earmarked a few sections to take out, just in case you don't like it, and we'll fix it, and da da da. And she said, okay, I'll get back to you. And so then when she got back to me, I said, okay, well, what are we cutting? We were on the phone. She said, oh, we're not cutting any of it. And I said, what? No, this is huge. She said, a suitable boy was over 1,000. You know, she starts listing all of these books, right? She said, this is a magisterial epic. This is beautiful. At that point, it was 700 pages.
Oh my gosh. Great.
And when we got to line edits, then I added another 100 pages. And then, you know, then we began to trim, and we cut it down to the bone. But I was still very frightened until I got that first starred review from Publishers Weekly.
Oh, I could see this another, you know, no pressure, but really it should be another 500 pages. I mean, I was really waiting for Coco's point of view.
Well, you know, the thing about Coco is she may or may not be showing up in another book.
Oh, good.
So, yeah. There you go. You know, I wanted to get my skills right.
Well, you did.
before I turn to, because I think Coco's story really is one that deserves a lot.
Yeah. You
know? Yes.
And your office looks like what? Because you have 800 pages of, you know, a lot of story, a lot of characters. And how do you keep it all straight? We got to draw down on our time, but I do really want to know how you keep all of this straight.
How I keep it all straight? You do. That is when outlining comes in. So when you write your first draft, there are a lot of mistakes that you're making. A lot of timeline mistakes. You might duplicate names, because there's, you know, a cast of hundreds, you know, in this book. You might duplicate names. You might do those sort of things and genealogies. So that is when you come back in the second and third, fourth draft, right, that you begin to really start trying to keep people straight, right? Yep.
Okay.
Who and all of that. And it was a lot. And I was really tired. I'm just, and then the pandemic hit. So all of that. And I was also writing another book at the time that I was writing this book.
Oh my God. Oh, wow.
Oh, okay. The Age of Phyllis, my fifth book of poetry.
Oh, sure. Right.
I was writing that at the same time. I'm always writing two or three projects at the same time because I can get very depressed if I get stuck and the words don't come. I'm pretty cheerful about my writing, but I can get really sad if things get stuck. And then what I do is I just pivot to another project and then I pivot back.
And it's nice that the other project is poetry because that would be an easy pivot. You're not going to get confused, right, with what you're working on.
No. And as a matter of fact, because The Age of Phyllis was the first book of poetry, the only book of poetry that I've ever written that's based upon research. Every poem is based upon research.
Yep.
A lot of the research, and because the book is set in the 18th century, a lot of the research that I did for The Age of Phyllis, I was very useful for love songs.
Oh,
for
example, sure.
The slave trade, Wolof culture, et cetera. So yeah, when you get old, like I am, you know, I'm in my 50s, when we know what your vision is for your career, when you first start writing, you just get in where you fit in. You just hope that you're going to keep writing. But after a while, your work begins to coalesce around a series of themes, a series of artistic concerns, in my case, a series of historical concerns. And so you begin to understand why you're here.
And isn't that nice? You know, when you can stop searching and dig in. Yeah, isn't that nice?
I'm very grateful.
Well, this was a remarkable achievement. And speaking of all of the character names were just fantastic. That must have been a whole nother fun project to come up with just the right names for these people because...
Yes. My favorite is Miss Rose Collins Driscoll. First name, Miss, middle name,
yes.
Rose.
Yes, yes. You will never disrespect me. My name is Miss. I loved it.
Never disrespect me. My name is Miss.
I loved it. I loved every minute of this. Congratulations. You're going to have just a fun ride with this. And I can't wait to watch it. And I can't wait to read about Coco. I'm sitting in the wings waiting for you to write fast. So
I'll do my best.
Honoré Jeffers, this was such a pleasure. Thank you so, so much for taking the time.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you.
That's all the time we have for today. That was Honoré Jeffers. The book we were talking about was The Love Songs of W.E.B. Du Bois. We will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.